Frantically, Mefrou Stunder rang the exchange and asked to be reconnected to her son. But it took 15 minutes before the operator called her back. "There's no reply from your Joburg number." Sarah was distraught. She roamed around her kitchen, the midday meal forgotten, twisting her apron in her fingers, trying desperately to think of some way of reaching her son. When her husband came in through the front door, she rushed down the passageway and threw her arms around his neck, and she gabbled out her fears. "Marnie," Rolf said. "I'll telephone him. He can send one of his men around to Corbus's flat." "Oh, why didn't I think of that?" Sarah sobbed. The secretary in Manfred's ministry told them he was not available and would not be in again until Monday morning. "What will we do now?" Rolf was as worried as she was. "Lothi," Sarah brightened. "He's in the police in Johannesburg. Ring Lothi. He will know what to do." Jacobus Stander broke the connection to his mother and jumped to his feet. He knew he must act quickly and decisively now. Already he had wasted too much time. They would be coming for him soon. He picked up the suitcase and left the flat, locking the door behind him. He rode down in the lift, still holding the heavy suitcase, even though the handle cut into his fingers. There were two girls in the lift with him. They ignored him and chatted to each other all the way down. He watched them surreptitiously. "It may be you," he thought. "It could be anybody." The girls barged out of the lift ahead of him, and he followed slowly, walking lopsidedly because of the weight of the brown suitcase. He caught the bus at the corner and took the seat nearest the door, placing the suitcase on the seat beside him, but retaining his grip on the handle all the way. The bus stopped outside the side entrance of the Johannesburg railway station, and Jacobus was the first passenger to alight. Lugging the suitcase, he started towards the station entrance, and then his steps began to drag and his mouth went dry with terror. There was a constable of the railway police at the entrance, and as Jacobus hesitated, he looked directly at him. Jacobus wanted to drop the suitcase and run back to the bus, which was pulling away behind him. But the press of other passengers bore him forward like a dead leaf in a stream. He did not want to catch the constable's eye. He trudged forward, head bowed, concentrating on the heels of the fat woman in white shoes just ahead of him. He looked up as he came level with the station portals, and the constable was walking away from him, his hands clasped lightly behind his back. Jacobus's legs felt rubbery, and his relief was so intense that he thought he was going to be ill. He fought down his nausea and kept on going with the stream of commuters. At the centre of the concourse, under the high, arched skylight of glass, there was a goldfish pond surrounded by wooden benches. Although most of the benches were crowded with travellers snatching a few minutes' rest between trains or awaiting the arrival of friends, there was room for Jacobus at the end of one of them. He sat down and placed the suitcase between his feet. He was sweating heavily, and he had difficulty in breathing. Waves of nausea kept welling up from the pit of his guts, and there was a bitter, sick taste at the back of his throat. He wiped his face with his handkerchief and kept swallowing hard until gradually he had control of himself again. Then he looked around him. The other benches were still crowded. In the centre of the one facing him, there was a mother with two daughters. The youngest one was still in napkins. She sat on her mother's lap with a dummy in her mouth. The elder girl had skinny, sun-browned legs and arms and frilly petticoats under her short skirt. She leaned against her mother's side and sucked a lollipop on a stick. Her mouth was dyed bright red by the sticky candy. All around Jacobus passed a continual stream of humanity, coming and going down the broad staircase that led up to the street. Like columns of ants, they spread out to reach the separate platforms, and the loudspeakers boomed out information on arriving and departing trains, and the hiss and huff of escaping steam from the locomotives echoed against the high arches of glass above where Jacobus sat. He looked down at the suitcase between his feet. He had drilled a needle hole through the imitation leather. A strand of piano wire emerged from the aperture, and he had fixed a brass curtain ring to the end of it, and taped the ring to the brown leather beside the handle. Now he picked the tape with his fingernail and peeled it away. He stuck his forefinger through the brass ring and gently pulled the wire taut. There was a muted click from the interior of the suitcase, and he started guiltily and looked around him again. The little girl with the lollipop stuck in her cheek had been watching him. She gave him a sticky smile and shyly cuddled closer to her mother's side. Using his heels and the back of his legs, Jacobus pushed the suitcase slowly under the bench on which he was seated. Then he stood up and walked briskly across to the men's toilets on the far side of the concourse. He stood in front of one of the porcelain urinals and checked his wristwatch. It was 2:10. He zipped up his fly and walked out of the men's room. The mother and the two little girls were still sitting where he had left them, and the brown suitcase lay under the bench opposite. As he passed the child, she recognized him and smiled again. He did not return the smile, but went up the staircase into the street. He walked down to the Langham Hotel at the corner and went into the men's bar. He ordered a cold castle beer and drank it slowly, standing at the bar, checking his wristwatch every few minutes. He wondered if the mother and the two little girls had left, or if they were still sitting on the bench. The ferocity of the explosion shocked him. He was almost a block away, but it knocked over his glass, and the dregs of the beer ran across the bar top. There was consternation throughout the barroom. Men were swearing with surprise and astonishment, and rushing to the door. Jacobus followed them out into the street. The traffic had stopped, and people were swarming out of the buildings to block the pavements. From the station entrance a cloud of dust and smoke billowed, and through it staggered vague shadowy figures, powdered with dust, their clothing hanging off them in rags. Somewhere a woman began to scream, and all around him there were shouted questions. "What is it? What happened?" Jacobus turned and walked away. He heard the sirens of the police cars and the fire engines coming closer, but he did not look back. "No, Tanisari, I haven't seen Kobus since we last met at Waterkloof," Lothar de la Rey tried to be patient. The Stunders were old friends of his parents, and he had spent many happy childhood holidays at the cottage on the Stunder farm at the seaside. That was before Rolf Stunder had been forced to sell the farm. "Yes, yes, Tani. I know, but Kobus and I live in different worlds now. I know how worried you must be." "Yes, of course." Lothar was taking the call in his private office in the headquarters complex of Marshall Square, and he glanced at his wristwatch as he listened to Sarah Stander's plaintive voice. It was just before 2:00. "What time was it when he telephoned you?" Lothar asked, and listened to her reply. "Well, that was an hour ago. Where did he say he was speaking from?" "All right, Tani. What's his address in Hillbrow?" He scribbled it on the pad in front of him. "Now tell me, Tani, what was it exactly he said?" "Something terrible, and you must forgive him." "Yes, that doesn't sound very good, I agree. Suicide?" "No, Tani, sorry, I'm sure he didn't mean that. But I will send one of my men to check his flat. Why don't you ring the university in the meantime?" One of the other telephones on his desk squealed, and he ignored it. "What did they say at the university?" he asked. "All right, Tani, I'll telephone you and Rolf just as soon as I have any news." By now all three of his telephones were shrilling, and Captain Lawrence, his assistant, was signalling him frantically from the door of his office. "Yes, I understand, Tani Sari. Yes, I promise I will telephone you, but I must ring off now." Lothar replaced the receiver and looked up at Lawrence. "Yeah, what is it, man?" "An explosion at the main railway station. It looks like another bomb." Lothar jumped to his feet and snatched up his jacket. "Casualties?" he demanded. "There are bodies and blood all over the place." "The bloody swines," Lothar said bitterly. The street was cordoned off. They left the police car at the barrier, and Lothar, who was in plain clothes, showed his identification, and the sergeant saluted him. There were 5 ambulances parked outside the station entrance, with their lights flashing. At the head of the staircase leading down into the main concourse, Lothar paused. The damage was terrible. The glass in the arched skylights had been blown out, and it coated the marble floors, glittering like a field of ice crystals. The restaurant had been turned into a first aid station, and the white-jacketed doctors and ambulance crews were at work. The stretcher-bearers were carrying their grisly loads up the staircase to the waiting vehicles. The officer in charge of the investigation was a major from Marshall Square. He had his men searching the wreckage already, working methodically in an extended line across the concourse. He recognized Lothar and beckoned to him. The glass crunched under Lothar's feet as he crossed to join him. "How many dead?" he asked without any preamble. "We've been incredibly lucky, Colonel. About 40 injured, mostly by flying glass, but only one dead." He reached down and pulled back the plastic sheet that was spread at his feet. Under it lay a little girl in a short dress with a frilly lace petticoat. Both her legs and one arm had been blown away, and the dress was soaked with her blood. "Her mother lost both eyes, and her little sister will lose one arm," the major said, and Lothar saw that the child's face was miraculously unscathed. She seemed to be sleeping. Her mouth was bright red with sticky sugar, and in her remaining hand she still clutched the stick of a half-eaten lollipop. "Lawrence," Lothar said quietly to his assistant, "ring records. Use the telephone in the restaurant. Tell them I want a computer run on my desk when I get back to the square. I want the name of every known white radical on the list. It had to be a white man in this section of the station." He watched Lawrence cross the concourse, and then he looked down at the tiny body under the plastic sheet. "I'm going to get the bastard who did this," he whispered. "This one isn't going to get away." His staff were waiting for him when he got back to the office, 40 minutes later. They had already vetted the computerized list and checked the names of those in detention, in exile, or those whose whereabouts could be assumed to be outside the Witwatersrand area. There remained 396 suspects unaccounted for. They were listed in alphabetical order, and it was almost 4 o'clock before they had worked down to the S section. As Lothar folded over the last sheet of the printout, the name seemed to leap from the page at him. Stunder, Jacobus Petrus. In the same moment, Sarah Stunder's plaintive voice echoed in his ears. "Stunder," he said crisply. "This one is a new addition." He had last checked the list 24 hours before. It was one of the most important tools of his trade, the names upon it so familiar that he could conjure up each face clearly in his mind's eye. Corbus' name had not been there on his last reading. Captain Lawrence picked up the internal telephone to records and spoke to the files clerk on the section. Then he turned back to Lothar as he hung up the receiver. "Stunder's name comes from the interrogation of a member of the African resistance movement, Bernard Fisher. He was arrested on the 5th, 2 days ago. Stunder is a lecturer at Wits University." "I know who he is." Lothar strode out of the operations room into his private office and ripped the top sheet off his notepad. "And I know where he is." He drew the .38 police special from his shoulder holster and checked the load as he gave his orders. "I want 4 units of the flying squad and a break-in team with flak jackets and shotguns, and I want photographs of the bomb victims. The girl." The flat was on the 5th floor, at the end of a long open gallery. Lothar placed men on every stairwell and both fire escapes, at the lift station and in the main lobby. He and Lawrence went up with the break-in team, and they all moved stealthily into position. With the police special cocked in his right hand, his back against the wall, clear of the door, he reached out and rang the bell. There was no reply. He rang again, and they waited tensely. The silence drew out. Lothar reached out to ring a third time, when there were light, hesitant footsteps beyond the glass panel door. "Who is it?" a breathless voice called. "Corbus, it's me, Lothi." "Leave her here, sweet God," and the sound of running footsteps receded into the flat. "Go," said Lothar, and the hammer man from the break-in team stepped up to the door with the 10-pound sledgehammer. The lock burst open at the first stroke, and the door crashed back against its hinges. Lothar was the first one in. The lounge was deserted, and he ran straight through into the bedroom. Behind him, Lorenz shouted, "Pass op! Look out! He might be armed!" But Lothar wanted to stop him reaching a window and jumping. The bathroom door was locked, and he heard running water beyond it. He took the door with his shoulder, and the panel splintered. His own momentum carried him into the bathroom. Jacobus was leaning over the wash basin, shaking tablets from a bottle into the palm of his hand and cramming them into his mouth. His cheeks bulged, and he was gagging and swallowing. Lothar brought the barrel of the revolver down on the wrist that held the bottle, and the bottle shattered into the basin. He caught Jacobus by his long hair and forced him to his knees. He wedged open his jaws with thumb and forefinger, and with the fingers of his other hand hooked the crushed, damp porridge of tablets out of his mouth. "I want an ambulance team with a stomach pump up here," he yelled at Lorenz, "and get in an analysis of that bottle, its label and contents." Jacobus was struggling, and Lothar hit him open-handed, back and across the face. Jacobus whimpered and subsided, and Lothar thrust his forefinger deeply down his throat. Gasping and choking and retching, Jacobus started struggling again, but Lothar held him easily. He worked his forefinger around in his throat, keeping on even when hot vomit spurted up over his hand. Satisfied at last, he let Jacobus lie in a puddle of his own vomit while he rinsed his hands in the basin. He dried his hands and seized Jacobus by the back of his shirt. He hauled him to his feet, dragged him through into the lounge, and flung him into one of the armchairs. Lorenz and the forensic team were already working over the apartment. "Did you get the photographs?" Lothar asked, and Lorenz handed him a buff envelope. Jacobus sat huddled in the chair. His shirt was fouled with vomit, and his nose and eyes were red and running. The corner of his mouth was torn where Lothar had forced it open, and he was trembling violently. Lothar sorted through the contents of the envelope, and then he laid a glossy black-and-white print on the coffee table in front of Jacobus. Jacobus stared at it. It was a photograph of the truncated body of the child, nestled in a pool of her own blood, with the lollipop in her hand. He began to weep. He sobbed and choked and turned his head away. Lothar moved around behind his chair and caught the back of his neck, forced his head back. "Look at it," he ordered. "I didn't mean it," Jacobus whispered brokenly. "I didn't mean it to happen." The cold white fury faded from Lothar's brain, and he released Jacobus's head and stepped back from him uncertainly. Those were the words he had used. "I didn't mean it to happen." The exact words he had used as he had stood over the black boy with the dead girl's head cradled in his lap and the raw wounds running red into the dust of Sharpeville. Suddenly Lothar felt weary and sickened. He wanted to go away by himself. Lorenz could take over from here, but he braced himself to fight off the despair. He laid his hand on Jacobus's shoulder, and the touch was strangely gentle and compassionate. "Jacobus, we never mean it to happen, but still they die. Now it's your turn, Corbus. Your turn to die. Come, let's go."